Good. So, hi, Glenn.
Hey, John, how are you?
I am flying high for the most part, and the news gets more interesting every day, especially on the topics that we've been discussing. Did you see that the Wall Street Journal NBC poll has Mr. Obama ahead by 10 points today?
I heard that. I didn't actually see the poll or any of the internals, but I did hear a report or read one on the newspaper this morning when I was just, you know. Yep.
Yep. And we have Colin Powell, and that endorsement.
The Colin Powell endorsement, that's a big thing.
And that made a difference in donations, in addition. And so
pardon me?
That made a difference in donations, in addition. And so my initial thought was, how much do these endorsements really matter? And in this case, it actually did have an effect. And so that happened. And, and we had our third debate. And I don't think that that did Obama any damage. And so that's something that we can talk about as well. What did you think of the third debate?
Well, you know, Obama looks like he's going to win the election. So are all the indicators, I suppose. One doesn't go too far out on a limb saying that. And I think the interesting questions now start to become, wow, you know, what's the significance of that?
Mm-hmm.
And also, what does it imply? You know, I mean, it's hugely momentous thing, and I'm sort of staggered by it. I think, you know, we don't have enough distance from events maybe to fully appreciate, but I'm just thinking in my little corner of the world, which is economics, social policy, inequality, race, identity, sort of political economics, culture, things of this kind, it is a hugely historical development, and it's going to affect scholarship and critical discourse for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think also that it is that the campaign has been so deeply, it's not over yet, no, but it's just about over, and it's been so deeply, so rich in all kinds of, you know,
it
insights
has been
and
an
things
opera.
About American culture.
It's been an opera.
You know.
Yeah.
Pardon?
It has been an opera. I can't wait to see the literature, the Oliver Stone movie, most likely, and literally the opera. I guarantee you in 10 years, somebody will write an opera about 2008. It's been astounding, the literary richness of it. You know, Sarah Palin, you know, it just goes on and on and on. I've been really overwhelmed. Absolutely overwhelmed. And I who would have known? Hurricane Katrina, back when the big race issue was that, which wasn't that long ago. That was late 2005, well into 2006.
3 years ago.
Who would have thought that very soon after that, that as soon as the furor over that died down, as soon as, unfortunately, a kind of Katrina fatigue set in, that the next thing was going to be not one more black person running for president, but one actually almost certainly becoming president. It's just the sort of thing you would never have expected.
John, I'm shocked at... No, I'm not shocked because you've been saying this for months. But maybe I want to say I'm disappointed at the easy invocation of this... you know, that you've just articulated, the easy adoption, you know, the embrace of this narrative that I want to resist. In fact, I think one of the things at stake now is interpretation. You know, what does it mean?
Yeah.
And now you've linked this to Hurricane Katrina, and you've called this man about to be elected as president a black person whose success is exceptional in light of Hurricane Katrina. Somehow, and I don't want to put words into your mouth,
mm-hmm.
balances or contradicts, cancels out or is indicative of a different vector of racial
out,
significance
just,
in our society?
No, not cancels out, just shows a different side. I think it's a counterbalance.
Well, yeah, but this is, a balance sheet of racial grievance, and I'm not accusing you of being a grievance monger.
Mm-hmm.
Quite the contrary. You're an anti-grievance monger.
Right, yeah,
you're
I'm
in the same business.
Understand, right.
This balance sheet of racial grievance, we're in one Katrina is on one side of the ledger, and one Obama success is on the other side of the ledger.
Oh, I know where you're going. We'll go ahead and finish, because I have something to say to this.
Well, I'll be brief. I'm just saying, hurrah for Barack Obama. I'm staggered and will be years in digesting what all this implies about politics, power, and race in American society. But the one thing I'm fairly certain of is that the deep structure of Katrina, that is, the disaster of New Orleans, the Lower Ninth Ward, the pictures from the Superdome, the evident status of the people who were subject to that disaster within the larger structure of American society, their subordinate status, is not much touched by and intersects only casually, in my view, with this other phenomenon, which I still don't claim to have any deep understanding of, which is the political entrepreneurship, the sort of seizing of the moment of this young man from Chicago and the movement that he's built, which is partly around race and partly around generational shift and partly around apparently tectonic plates of America's political sensibility moving as one kind of era comes to an end and another is being inaugurated, and also is apparently a reflection of tremendous skill, foresight, opportunism, the rest that have been reflected in the Obama campaign, both through the primaries and now a presidential election, looking like something. New politics of the 21st century in America, no more red state, blue state, that whole thing there. That's a completely different thing,
Glenn,
to me than the deep structure of Katrina. So the people who want to say, racial progress is being illustrated here, well, to a certain degree, but I think that's a minor key. That's a minor note relative to, the other things that are going on.
You know what I hear in what you're saying, and this time I don't want to put words into your mouth, but this brings me in mind, and I'm going to kind of go round the back here, but this is important, of a conversation I had with somebody who comes up between us rather often, Cornel West. I finally met him a few weeks ago.
He was the last
black star intellectual or whatever who I hadn't met, just by chance. Yeah. And we were on a panel and got along very well. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. But we had one exchange where we never really resolved it, where it finally came down to him saying, but oh, no, Brother McWhorter, you have to realize that as a thinking person, as an intellectual, it's your job to contest, because he was criticizing Obama for not having mentioned Martin Luther King in a speech. And I actually said, and this was then we got derailed, I said, I disagree with that. I don't think that always it is the job of the intellectual or the pundit or whatever to be in opposition. And the reason that I say that, now I just got into the back door, now I'm back in the living room. The reason I say that is because I think that if Obama becomes president, then the next thing is going to be that for about 3 weeks, there's going to be the celebration. It's going to be a kind of celebration that I think you're going to be a little bit uncomfortable with, but it's going to be there just because of the sometimes shallow reasons for it, etc. After the 3 weeks of celebration, people are going to start peeping in with a new kind of thing, which is going to be this contesting. And I think that one of the contestings is going to be that, one of them is going to be that America wouldn't have elected a quote-unquote really black president. People are going to start talking about that. The other one, the big one, is going to be he didn't win by enough. The idea is going to be that the margin was rather small and that therefore that shows that we've still got racism running rampant throughout the land. But wait, that's just two things. The third thing, the main thing, is that people will say that he is not he's not proposing a significantly pro-black agenda. And that actually might take more than 3 weeks. I would call it 3 months. And after the first 100 days, the idea will be that he's in, he's black, his family's black, that says something about voting patterns and some change, but that now that he's in, it doesn't mean that anything's going to change. And the big mantra will be, I'm afraid that now that Obama's in, white people are going to forget about racism. I'm two-thirds of the way done. Just wait. And that is what people are going to say. And what I have to say to that is that, frankly, Glenn, yeah, if Obama is in, there's still going to be people on bar stools, and they are going to say, now you've got a black president, what more do you have to bellyache about? There are going to be people like that. And the fact of the matter is, we are going to have still problems where you can trace it to racism of institutional kind, such as what happened with Katrina. Those things are going to be there. But, you know, to tell the truth, it seems to me that with Obama in office, certainly we will at least stay at par in terms of where the discussion on racism is. The barstool people would have said it, whether something along those lines, whether Barack Obama was in or not. If they couldn't say that it's because we have a black president, they'd say it was because of a million other things. But in the meantime, you know, we will still have people like you and me talking about racism. Universities will talk about racism. There will be the museums. There'll be the TV specials.
Two sentences.
And a large class of people in this country will still consider racism to be something that they think about and that they are vigilant against. There will be no slide backwards and only room for a slide forwards. I'm done.
Yeah, well, what I have to say is, sure, there will be people saying the stuff that you're saying, yes. And great, you're going to rebut them saying so, so that we won't get mired in that kind of, if you will, silly conversation. I'm all for it. I'm on your side of that argument. Mm-hmm. But I think that's small potatoes. I mean, first of all, Obama is mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not lose track of that. I mean,
this
is
not... You're not supposed to say it.
Pardon?
You're not supposed to say that too loud. But go ahead.
There are a number of things that aren't supposed to be said, which I think are very interesting. And what I want to say here is that the reason why I say it's small potatoes is that the fight with these 1970s-esque critics about how racist is America and so on is so 20th century. it's a little corollary to the culture wars that Obama is, even as we speak, rendering completely irrelevant. I mean, I don't mean that, you know, against you. As I say, I think, you know, rebutting those kinds of, you know, interpretations, you know, racism is still here, Obama's not radical enough, blah, blah. If he had, you know, been any blacker, he couldn't have gotten elected. Yeah, I mean, rebutting all that kind of conversation is probably worth doing. But I think there are just much more profound things that are being said to us about race. So, as I say, first of all, there's this identity issue. Barack Obama's blackness is complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the significance of him being linked to King,
mm-hmm,
within the American pantheon, which if he succeeds in this election is certain to happen,
mm-hmm,
right? He's certain to come into the historical lore and the kind of self-understanding narrative of the American nation on a par with, okay? I'm not begrudging that at all. I'm not criticizing it at all. I'm simply taking note of it. And it says something about the porousness of black identity. I mean, is it a flat world? You bet it is. Are we a nation of immigrants? You bet we are. And whereas the history of slavery on the one hand and the history of immigration on the other in our country have stood in a kind of juxtaposition or at least a occasional ill ease, they're now being melded together in some profound way in the very person of this individual. I think that's really significant. Secondly, The massive increase in African-American participation in presidential electoral politics, which I believe the statistics will show after the fact, the huge turnout, the mobilization, the registration, the early voting, the voting, the photographs of long lines of people, the polarized numbers that are going to come in a state like Ohio or Pennsylvania from the large urban population centers on the one hand,
yeah,
and the others on the other. And I'm not trying to make a problem here. I'm just making an observation. This is huge. I mean, I don't know what this means entirely, but if you think that the Christian right was a powerful force in American politics in the era of Reagan, you best believe that this newly mobilized coalition of African-American youthful voters, whatever. I mean, it's too early to tell, and I'm not really a political, you know, analyst expert. I'm not going to try to pretend to something that I don't really understand here.
Right.
But it feels very deeply significant to me in terms of the changing alignments of demographic groups and clusters. And I'm sure that there's going to be both benefit and conflict,
you know,
that ensues out of that.
Yeah, it's going to be very...
It's worth analyzing.
Yeah, oh, it is. It's going to be very complicated. And it's interesting about this conception of what kind of black person he is, because early on, I thought of him primarily as a hybrid person, and I thought that was interesting. And you think about, you know, what especially white people tend to say about what he signifies for America. But somewhere around a year and a half ago, there was a transition in the general conversation. Everybody accepted that he was black with a capital B, and it became impolite to question whether he was black enough. And in my experience, when you say that one person is blacker than another, it really tends to baffle many people, and I mean people of all walks. The standard response is, quote-unquote, what's that all about? And the underlying implication of that seems to be that you're associating blackness with certain silly stereotypes and that that's the only place you could possibly be going conversation over. Whereas really, at least in my mind, blackness is a construct of, well, no, I don't want to say construct. It is various cultural factors. Who could count them? But, you know, just like any subculture in the world. And that some people are part of it to more of a degree than other people. And I would say that, therefore, in my taxonomy, Spike Lee is more black American than Barack Obama, and that's just fine. I have found that to actually say that is to stir up so much and to be so subject to misunderstanding that, you know, I think we should almost be reluctant to bring it up. But I think that because Obama is who he is, and because we're no longer allowed to say that he might be less black than other people because people seem to think that that must be a judgment, it's going to make a different conception, I think subconsciously for many people, of what black is. I think it's going to be more flexible. You know, the kind of tension that there's always been in our culture between show enough black folks versus the other ones and whether somebody has lost touch with their identity and all that. I think for that generation you're talking about, who don't know about our culture wars conversations of the 70s. God, that makes me feel old, but I do know what you mean. That's going to be different. They're going to be able to see a conception of blackness that is more flexible. There's going to be less of a sense that the person who did not do the sorts of things that the Fred Sanford character did on Sanford and Son has some explaining to do. I like it. I think we're going to have a larger, more flexible conception of what being a black person is, while white people get blacker every week themselves because of the cultural meltdown that we have in this country. That's what America's all about to me, and that's part of why Obama excites me.
Well, let's pursue this for a minute about what the implications for blackness and how that's understood in American political culture might be of Obama's success. And I'm thinking about two other black political figures, Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court, and General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You mentioned Powell's endorsement, which is relatively recent news, and of Obama's presidential ambitions as indication on Meet the Press that he would be voting for Obama, and the kind of firestorm of criticism mm-hmm. that's engendered from some, you know, Republican quarters about his right. disloyalty or whatever, and the speculation that his motives might have been, at least in part, to try
tribalist.
To, you know, rehabilitate himself,
Iraq,
you
right.
know, politically, from
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera. Powell, an African American, endorsing an African American, and some commentators, Rush Limbaugh, infamously, Patrick Buchanan. I saw a column of recently saying, you know, well, there's a racial, you know, dimension to that, as if, you know, that was somehow
wrong,
or could it possibly be that there wouldn't have
yeah,
been?
That's another thing, right?
At least in part, Paul admitted that that was part of his justification, but the least of it, he had other reasons, including reasons that he found McCain's campaign and, wanting, and indicated that. And Clarence Thomas, whom I remarked in one of our earlier conversations when Obama was asked who on the Supreme Court he wouldn't have appointed, was singled out in Senator Obama's response as someone he thought wasn't, you know, entirely sort of convincingly qualified to be on the court in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how unfortunate it is.
Yeah, you didn't like that. Right.
For African Americans. I mean, not to defend Thomas as such, not in any partisan way. No, I didn't like it at all. I thought, in its ancient history now, but it is somehow indicative of the complexity of this question about race and racial representation. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, Thomas, you know, arch conservative member of the court, extremely controversial. Many African Americans annoyed at him, feeling that he's a traitor somehow. On the other hand, Thomas confirmed to the court by the loyal support of African Americans, especially in southern states. I mean, there is some irony that in some ways Obama's success rides in part on some of the same kinds of racial loyalty sentiments.
Sure.
And this issue of respect and honor, what, you know, so in the phenomenon of Obama, which I find very interesting, you know, he starts out, he's young, he's inexperienced, and the question is whether or not, in a way, he's competent. And that question is tied up with race because, you know, for a white person to stand up and say a black person is incompetent, given our history, you know, well, that's kind of problematic. And we saw some of the white candidates who were running against Obama. They've gotten into one or another kind of trouble from time to time from not being careful enough about not
disrespecting
him in that way.
Including McCain now.
Yeah. But now he's beaten that charge back, it would appear. Mm-hmm. He has established his competency and all that goes into that, you know, his Harvard pedigree, his tremendous personal skills, his articulateness and ability to use the language in such a convincing way, and so on. Together with the fact that so many distinguished people have come alongside, that of course has its own dynamic. The more close it looks like he's going to succeed, the more the interest that people will have in aligning themselves with him, and there's a kind of snowballing effect there. But anyway, he has constructed himself quite successfully as someone who has the mastery, has the capacity, has the ability. Mm-hmm. This is very significant in terms of diminution of stigma against African Americans, mm-hmm. sort of establishing beyond any doubt that there is really no arena within which African Americans cannot effectively compete and so forth. But again, I don't want to filibuster here. Let me try to bring this. I'm just saying, if we look at these different cases, Powell, Thomas, and Obama, we kind of see some of the complexity and the sort of dynamism in that's built into in the role that race is playing in American politics. Obama's apparent success is a huge chapter in that.
It really is, and you know, it's interesting because since formally this is supposed to be about the third debate, but I think we can even openly admit to viewers that you and I decided a little while ago that the third debate was so relatively unmomentous and kind of confirmed things we had said before, that we found that doing one just on that debate wouldn't have been very illuminating. But
I did watch the third debate.
Yeah, and I think to touch on it and to connect with what you just said, I think that, yes, it is certainly fascinating to look at these contrasting black identities and the interactions between them. And I think all of us can agree that it's something interesting to watch. And what really struck me in the third debate was that McCain, and as I said in our last one, it's not that I have some hatred for him or that I want to think of him as a footnote to history. I don't know why I think that's so funny, but he's not a footnote. But the way McCain can look at him, it's almost like he listened to our blocking hits or something. So now he turns and puts his eyes upon him. But it's so clear that McCain has such a contempt for Obama, and I find that more than I did in the first debate. Like, at one point, he called him. He was speaking quickly. He called him Obama. The man is sitting 2 inches from him, and he mentioned Obama, or Senator Obama. Barack Obama called him John many times. John McCain could not simply say Barack, the way almost everybody in the country does now. And it's interesting because Hillary, I hate calling her that. Hillary Clinton always would show, you know, despite the nastiness of the situation, despite the pot shots that she had to put forth because she was trying to win, you could always tell that she understood that there was something special going on in terms of race and in terms of this new representative, if you want to call him one. And you definitely see it now. She doesn't hate him. She can see that there's something worthwhile in this being our narrative, if I may put it that way, right now. McCain doesn't see that at all. He's not turned on by it. He has.
I think that's right about McCain, but I think that's probably reflective of a large minority of our country. I don't think McCain is alone. I think there are many people standing back agape, I meant to say,
that this is happening,
and maybe aghast at the prospect And I don't mean this in some that they're not some small-minded. You know, I mean, the people who would say, here's a community organizer, the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate, somebody who's, et cetera, you know how this litany is going to go.
Right.
Who's going to be the commander-in-chief, who's going to be the leader of the free world, and who's going to be sitting down and, you know, representing our country, leading and making these fundamental decisions and so forth. How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say, this is something that a coastal elite... mainstream media that just fell in love with a certain story, various powerful interests, and you know, you can sort of create your own conspiracy theory here by mixing in various elements of different, you know, different tales about powers, you know, puppeteers behind the scenes pulling the strings, and where's the money coming from, and who, and so forth and so on. You know, they're prevailing over someone might feel like a John McCain or a John McCain supporter more, you know, and any word you use here is going to potentially be offensive, but more authentic or somehow more traditional or, you know, whatever,
but
sources.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to be in the room.
Yeah, what,
when Obama sits down with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with General Petraeus and the others, and you know all that's going to come along with it, I would love to know, you know, sort of what the dynamics of power, deference, status, and so forth would be like in those rooms where respect shouldn't be taken for granted, even though you know some kind of formal or titular deference will certainly be offered.
Sure.
You know, I'd love to know what's going on in these closed rooms behind the scenes where powerful people who are seeing something revolutionary happen politically.
Yeah.
This is revolutionary.
Yeah. Although.
You know, are, you know, formulating their hedge strategies. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay, this guy's going to get in there. This and that is likely to happen. What about the defense contractors? What are they up to? What about the drug companies?
Sure.
What are they up to? What about the powerful interests who are concerned about, I don't know what, U.S.-China-Taiwan relations, U.S.-Israeli-Palestinian relations, doing to anticipate the possibly profound implications of this revolutionary insurgency?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think any of these words are hyperbolic.
Well, I think, you know, I think they are a little bit, because I think...
You don't think this is an insurgency?
No, I think if you think about it, once we've gotten to that point, where Obama and his people have consulted and wise heads have been consulted and there has been consensus and Barack Obama has gone off and thought and there are the realities of the world. Once it's at that point when he's sitting in those rooms with the pitchers of ice water and their negotiations, what's going to go on is not going to be shockingly different from what would have gone on if, say, Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton were in those same rooms, by which I mean to say that there is this insurgency, there's the revolutionary quality, there is Barack Obama's voting record, but I think he has made it perfectly clear that as somebody governing this nation, and in a way helping to govern the world, that is not the way that he would be. I mean, he is Mr. Consensus, and I think part of what I saw in the third debate, and part of what I see in these people who are aghast slash agape, is that especially in the debates, he has shown that he is not some wet-behind-the-ears closet radical from Chicago who wants to get into the White House and blow the roof of the place sky high. He wants to govern, and he understands. Just like, you know, the people who are now saying that Obama had the lurch to the right a couple of months ago, he's going to chart a middle path, okay, liberal, but it's not going to be what, you know, these radio talk show hosts, et cetera, seem to suspect. And yet, no matter what he says, no matter what he does, no matter how well he puts it, and now he's putting it well. He's actually giving policy prescriptions and, you know, nice, not sloganistically, but in good sound bite ways. I think it's good. He's doing what I was wishing he would do a month ago. But still there's this sense, what in the world is this person doing in here? And it seems that somebody like McCain has just shut out listening to what the man has to say. And yes, McCain is not unique.
John, I would say this. If Obama doesn't have an agenda other than what he has been willing to state in this campaign, I would be both surprised and profoundly disappointed. I would be. In fact, I've thought all along that that's one of the most fascinating aspects of this whole
phenomenon. Stealth bomb Obama, you mean?
Pardon?
Stealth bomb Obama, you mean? Like once he gets in, he's going to do things that he wasn't going to talk too much about
on the trail? I'm just making a simple point. The point is... about transparency in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, no candidate, including candidate Obama, can afford to be transparent or completely sincere.
No.
Now, we all know that, okay? So that when they posture or do the things that are necessary to the business that they're in, we discount that, right? I mean, for example, while Obama has had to run somewhat against free trade, the feeling, I think, from many people and the hope is that he would govern rather more sympathetic to the deep interest that we people of the world have in the creation and maintenance of institutions that keep borders open and keep goods flowing. I don't think he disagrees with that. I think he's liable to be less of a protectionist than the unions who support him would have him be.
That's what he says.
That's good. For example, with respect to ending the war in Iraq, again, I think that at the end of the day, he'll be less radical with respect to the position of withdrawal and more influenced by the imperatives of the facts on the ground as relayed by his military advisors and so forth than perhaps, you know, the Netroots folks at the left wing of the Democratic Party would have it.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that, you know, I mean, we could go down a list of issues of that kind. I mean, I think if a guy who sat for 20 years in Jeremiah Wright's church
mm-hmm.
gets elected president of the United States mm-hmm. and doesn't have a policy toward the Middle East that is informed by a different sensibility than what has been the bipartisan view about the Middle East to this point,
yeah.
What a travesty that would be. What a kind of usurpation of democracy that would be. I just mean democracy with a small d. I just mean the idea that the people rule. I mean,
you are going to be,
you know,
disappointed.
So posturing, here's what I'm trying to say. Oppose, okay, the creation of an image, the selling of a candidate versus governing. And where the drive, the vision for governing comes from, I mean, it's not just he's a centrist or he's a compromiser, he's going to weigh all these different views. Doesn't he have views? Of course he has views.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't he have a philosophical, ideological sensibility?
Mm-hmm.
Of course he has. Now, to run for office, you don't advertise that. No one does.
Sure.
But to govern, you only got 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay? He'll be 55 years old when he leaves office.
Yeah.
And you know, if he gets reelected.
Yeah.
This is it. You're not running for office anymore.
No.
You're governing.
No.
That's got to come from somewhere. It's got to mean something. That's why I say this is an insurgency.
Oh, sure. Okay.
You know.
So let's say that if you imagine a clock at noon and that's the center, then because, of course, Barack Obama does have views, I would imagine that his views will, you know, tip things to maybe the 11 to the left of the noon on the clock. And that's because this, and he knows this, this is a center-right country. This is not a leftist country by
right,
any means.
Right, and to succeed in anything he'd want to do, you have to take that into account.
And he knows, too, and this is what's important. One might think that he might run in wanting to really, really change things, but there's something that political scientists call path dependence. The fact that we've already gone down a certain path and we have a past example which looms over us now so that there's no going backwards. He knows what happened with the Clintons early on with things like
quote-unquote Hillary Care. They don't want to repeat
that. Also, he wouldn't do that. So I think that what we're going to have is somebody with healthy instincts, and they will show to an extent. But in terms of any kind of bomb throwing or any kind of major policy resetting, I can't see that he would be incautious enough to do it, because it might end up that he would only be in for 4 years instead of eight.
Well, all I'm saying is there's the front room and the back room. In the front room, you manage things in order to maintain your viability and your effectiveness within a system, recognizing the fact that your time dwindles down, so the closer you get to the end, the more important it is that you spend the political capital that you've built out. You don't want to go out with a whole lot of unspent political capital.
No.
But in the back room, there is the deeper commitment, vision, sort of ideological principle that should guide. A great leader has got to have that. And it's that thing about which we're guessing. We can only guess because the nature of a campaign is that you don't reveal that, but about which I think many people who support Obama and who are overjoyed at the prospect of his victory, have very clear you know, this issue about taxes and income redistribution and, you know, wealth and so forth. I mean, you know, that's obviously a fundamental, you know, ideological divide. And I think the wheel is turning. I mean, the Republicans repealing the death tax, you know, and so forth. I mean, the Phil Gramm ran in 96 on a everybody, it's time for people riding in the wagon to get out and help the rest of us push.
I remember that.
You know, yeah. All this kind of stuff. Well, we're a world away from that now. I mean, nobody's going to be talking about privatizing Social Security now.
The pendulum has shifted, yes.
Yeah. So these kind of things, and I, you know, anyway, I think we both have to go. So why don't we pick this up in our next conversation?
You know, we should. And yeah, Glenn, I wish you well, and let's keep watching.
Okay. Take care, John.
Take care.
Bye.